Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated November 7th, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's cover article, GSK's Dream Factory, how the drug giant is positioning its Zebulon plant for future gains. We'll take a look inside the plant that may save GlaxoSmithKline. This article is written by Jason DeBrun. Dozens of workers covered in blue suits buzz around manufacturing equipment as production lines hum away, filling dry powder in handheld inhaler devices. The machines might remind visitors of a Pixar cartoon with almost freakish precision as they roll strips into plastic dispensers and box them for distribution. It all happens at the GlaxoSmithKline manufacturing facility in Zebulon, a place that could mean as much to top GSK brass in London as any other location worldwide. The drug giant is entering a period of transition, specifically in the respiratory market that generates upwards of $11 billion in annual revenue, and that means big things for the Zebulon manufacturing plant. I've been here 28 years, and this is the most exciting time here at GSK, says Will Boykin, the Values Stream Director at GSK's Zebulon Manufacturing. For years, the Zebulon facility was one of three manufacturing sites for Advair, GSK's dry powder respiratory drug packaged in circular purple discus inhalers that has racked up tens of billions of unit sales and accounted for more than two-thirds of GSK's overall respiratory sales in the past decade. In some years, the Advair sales made up as much as 20% of GSK's total revenue for the entire company. GSK sells the same drug under the brand name Seretide outside the United States. In Zebulon, workers run four Advair production lines 24 hours per day, 5 days per week. One line takes four workers and can knock out about 14,000 filled discus devices per shift. In total, all lines can make 37 million devices in 1 year. The future of Advair, however, is likely to not be as glorious as its past, especially in the United States. Sales volume for Advair was down 10%, and GSK saw a 15% decline in price in the third quarter of 2014 as a result of new contract negotiations with payers. Indeed, GSK Chief Executive Andrew Witty and Chief Financial Officer Simon Dingmans haven't minced words recently about the future expectations of Advair. They predict continued declining revenue figures both as a result of lower volumes and lower prices as health insurers and government payers negotiate lower price points for drugs, particularly in the competitive respiratory market. Advair will roll off patent in 2016. While producing a generic version of this drug is more difficult than some standard small molecule white pills, a generic will certainly hit markets at some point in the not-too-distant future. So where does that leave the Zebulon plant and the hundreds of workers who call the plant on North Arundale Avenue their home away from home? Witty and his team have a transition strategy. The capital investment and the production structure suggest Zebulon will play no small role in that transition and help shore up GSK's top and bottom lines. GSK has been working to develop the next generation of respiratory drugs to make up for declining Advair demand. In 40 years, GSK brought six new respiratory drugs to market. In a two-year span, it will now bring six more to market, some to replace Advair, others to break into new areas of the respiratory market. As GSK transitions, it will sell new dry powder respiratory drugs, including Breo, Anoro, Arnuity, and Incruse, that are delivered through its newly approved Ellipta inhaler. Ellipta is not unlike the Discus in its baseline function, but it offers some advancements, including the capability to package two drugs in one device for combination therapy. To make it happen, the company is leaning on the Zebulon plant to produce them. Already, the company has invested $90 million between Zebulon and another non-GSK manufacturer in order to bring these new products to market, and will hire 60 to 70 new workers. The market for these drugs is potentially huge. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that 40 million people in the United States have been diagnosed with asthma in their lifetimes. Of those, 19 million adults and 7 million children still have asthma. The CDC estimates the total medical expenses of asthma to be north of $50 billion per year. A market of that size draws big players. Consider that AstraZeneca's Symbicort and Pulmicort combined for $4.35 billion last year, and Boehringer Ingelheim's Spiriva recorded $4.4 billion. That said, some of GSK's competitors are already feeling the pinch from generics. Merck & Company's asthma drug Singulair has gone from sales of $5.5 billion in 2011 to $1.2 billion in 2013. Furthermore, analysts at investment bank UBS don't see GSK's next-generation respiratory drugs immediately filling the void left by declining Advair sales. UBS sales projections show the new products hitting about $1 billion in sales by 2017 or 2018, and $2 billion by 2020. By then, however, UBS projects Advair sales to have declined to $2 billion annually. GSK has two other respiratory manufacturing facilities, one in France and one in the United Kingdom. After completing the company transition, GSK will produce only drugs for the Discus in France and drugs only for its new Ellipta device in the UK. Zebulon will be the only place in the world where both happen. Boykin is the son of a tobacco farmer and speaks in a distinctive Eastern North Carolina accent. He says he can remember the days when Zebulon produced the heartburn medicine Zantac. "We thought that was complicated then," he said. "It's nothing like it is now." That GSK chose Zebulon for its manufacturing site might seem somewhat strange, but it actually fits squarely within the company strategy. "GSK tends to put factories in smaller towns," says John Bola, GSK Vice President and Site Director of Zebulon Manufacturing. "We like the community it creates. It really drives longevity." Before long, the Zebulon plant will produce between 20 and 23 different drug brands for GSK that will be sold in 80 different ways in 54 countries. All this is done by a network of 900 workers in 700,000 square feet of factory space on 223 acres, about 40 miles from the Research Triangle Park. To Zebulon, population 5,000, the GSK facility is hugely important. The assessed value of GSK's real property totals about $243 million, or a full one-third of all taxable property value in town, according to the Zebulon Finance Department. At a rate of 52.5 cents per $100 of assessed value, every penny of property tax generates about $75,000 towards the town general budget. GSK pays nearly $1.3 million, or a third of the town's total property taxes. Industry, GSK included, makes up about 70% of the tax base and well above the 40% towns typically shoot for. Still, it can be a double-edged sword, as Mayor Bob Matheny points out. If one industry decides to leave, it would hurt the town's tax base a lot more than if one house were removed. Also, as equipment depreciates, it lowers the base, while residential homes typically don't depreciate in the same way. Not that we're afraid of anyone leaving, but that reality is there, Matheny says. GSK managers place a high emphasis on safety and efficiency. Throughout the day, workers will hold stand-up meetings in which groups of about a dozen gather in front of boards filled with charts and graphs. To the untrained eye, the numbers might look like gibberish, but each number and symbol represents a data point that allows everyone to know just how well they are working. If things are on track, a laminated green sheet displays that teams are firing on all cylinders. When things don't go well, the reverse side of that sheet displays red, letting all teams know that something needs improvement. Throughout the factory, all pieces of equipment are lined with photos depicting what a properly functioning machine should look like, drawing a comparison to fraud detectors trained to find counterfeit money by studying only real bills. Much of the quality control is done by machines, but humans also check behind the machines. There are lots of visual cues, Boykin says. A picture is worth a thousand words. Boykin regularly walks the production floor. I like when I see an operator standing around doing nothing, he jokes. That means everything is running smoothly. The facility has never been cited for an OSHA violation. Many employees work at an hourly rate, and GSK does not offer cash bonuses for any individual shifts that produce more than normal batches of drugs. Instead, the entire facility is evaluated on efficiency and offers bonuses, including to hourly workers, based on those factors. At shift change, workers from the exiting shift chat with those from the incoming one to discuss any issues or potential problems. There are some strong rituals, Boyle says. We are the last ones to touch a drug before the patient does. We take that seriously. The delivery method for a drug, be it the old Discus or the new Ellipta, is a little more than a piece of plastic that clicks through a strip and dispenses powder. Getting the powder just right, however, is no simple task. Workers carefully covered from head to toe mix the powder in batches. Portions of the process are measured by machine, others by humans. In some respects, making the dry powder drug is much like baking a cake, says Bola. Of course, the stakes are far higher. An improper measurement in a birthday cake will, at worst, spoil a birthday dessert. Improper measurements in a drug batch could mean bad health outcomes for anyone with a respiratory disease. That's partly why GSK has been running its new machines for months and will continue to run them for many more months without those batches of finished drugs ever reaching the lungs of a patient. It's all for practice, and hundreds of thousands of drug-filled inhaler devices will be trashed just to give the workers the proper muscle memory so they can effectively and efficiently pump out properly filled inhalers when the FDA gives the green light and the Zebulon factory begins churning out batches for real use. It's worth it down the road, Boykin says. Bola adds that the expertise and experience outweigh any additional cost. These are complicated medical devices, he says. That powder, delivered in the right consistency and amount at the right time, helps millions of people live more productive lives. The company's slogan is "Do more, feel better, live longer," and Bola says he wants to take that seriously. Nearly 4,000 miles away across the pond in London, Andrew Whitty, or Sir Andrew to some, knows all too well that this new crop of respiratory drugs could leave an imprint on his legacy as CEO. In a recent conference call, Whitty referenced the very significant changes that are taking place in the group's portfolio and the importance of GSK's strategy going forward so that we can replace the significant sales being lost to generics and ensure that the company can succeed in an environment where our biggest product, Advair, faces increasing competition. The launch of the new respiratory products has been slow out of the gate. Simon Dingmans, the GSK chief financial officer, met with sell-side analysts recently and confirmed that volumes and pricing were not what GSK had hoped. The key message was that 2015 will be tough, especially on the market front, according to a research note by UBS written shortly after the meeting. Dingmans described that not only Advair but also Breo and Anoro U.S. price levels will be considerably below last year's planning assumption, negatively affecting the gross profit level. Although Advair will soon roll off patent in the U.S., Whitty and Dingman say they don't fear a generic competitor before the end of 2016. Still, some analysts aren't as sure on that front, and even if no Advair competitor enters in 2016, they surely won't be far behind. When will respiratory return to growth? UBS analysts asked rhetorically before answering their own question. We do not project a near-term recovery and forecast respiratory sales to decline to 2019. It is unclear how Breo Anoro can make up for another $1 billion decline of U.S. Advair sales by the end of year 2016. And we continue to assume entry of generic Advair copies in the U.S. in 2017. For their part, Witte and Dingmans have stayed positive about future growth. If and when that growth happens, the GSK facility in Little Zebulon on the outskirts of Wake County will run at full speed ahead to produce many of those doses around the world. Exactly how do you make a drug? Well, at GSK, they've got a pretty simple process, although it will sound complicated. First, the bulk product is mixed to the right consistency. The drug is filled in long strips that are rolled on plates that almost resemble large, heavy lifting weights. Second, the strip is fed through a machine that splits the one strip into two, each with 30 individual dimples that contain one dose of Advair. Three, strips containing Advair are coiled and fed into the discus inhaler. Fourth, GSK receives the discus from a manufacturer. GSK does not make the discus device in Zebulon, but mixes Advair and fills the discus in Zebulon. Fifth, every 30 minutes, a discus inhaler is pulled and inspected. If something has gone wrong, the line is shut down to determine the error. Sixth place, each discus container, specific and FDA-regulated information. These stickers are placed on every discus. The seventh part is, after the discus inhaler has been filled with the Advair strips, sealed and received the proper labeling information, it's ready to be packaged and sent out the door. Step number eight, the discus inhaler is first sealed in an airtight container before it's being boxed. And the last step, number nine, Advair discus inhalers are placed in boxes that include full instructions. The boxes are then shipped to Richmond, Virginia for distribution. That's how you make a drug. Next up, Amanda Hoyle's column on commercial and residential real estate. Her lead article this week is Sales Booming in Smoking Hot Apartment Sector. Apartment investors from across the country were flocking to the Triangle throughout the month of October, contributing to one of the busiest months on record for the multifamily investment market. All total, 16 apartment communities with 4,400 apartment units total in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties were sold during the month of October for a combined $543.5 million. Plus, more deals are pending for November, December, and early 2015. Charlotte real estate development firm Crescent Communities has confirmed its plans to sell a portfolio of 9 new apartment communities in North Carolina, Florida, and Georgia, including 3 in the Triangle, in a deal valued at nearly $700 million. The buyer is to be a fund advised by UBS Global Asset Management and an unnamed private institutional group. In the Triangle, Crescent is selling the 282-unit Crescent Cameron Village in Raleigh that opened in September, the 303-unit Crescent 9th Street in Durham that opened in July, and the 208-unit Crescent Main Street in Durham that is still under construction. The 3 apartment communities in Raleigh and Durham are said to be valued at about $250,000 per unit, which would set a new record for the Triangle apartment market. The current record holder was the sale of the Park and Market apartments at North Hills in 2012 that sold for $200,489 per unit. The biggest disposition in October was the $1.8 billion joint venture portfolio sale by Greensboro-based Bell Partners and its joint venture partner DRA Advisors to the Texas private equity group Lone Star Funds. That deal included 7 apartment properties in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties that sold for a combined $323.2 million or about $135,000 per apartment unit, according to a review of county deed records. In Morrisville, the new Bristol apartment community, the only residential building within the 100-acre Park West Village retail and commercial center, was sold to Virginia-based investor Weinstein Properties for $53.4 million. The 260-unit complex's name has also been changed to Bexley at Park West Village to match the other seven Weinstein-owned apartment communities in the Triangle. Weinstein purchased the Morrisville complex from apartment developer Wood Partners, which had finished construction of the units in early 2014. Wood Partners and its equity partner in the deal, Prudential Real Estate Investors, had valued the project at around $34 million when construction began in 2012. This week's By the Numbers in the Commercial and Real Estate column, North Carolina's new EcoDevo group reveals its top donors. Leaders of the newly initiated Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina on October 31st released a report that disclosed more details about the nonprofit group's private financial backers, as well as a list of salaries for all its management staff. Starting at the low end, Charlotte Pipe and Foundry Company with a $5,000 contribution, $60,000 was contributed by Lenovo Group Limited, Piedmont Natural Gas I anteed up at $75,000. Red Hat stepped in with a $100,000 contribution, and leading the list of private donors is Duke Energy with a $200,000 contribution. Top executives at both Red Hat and Lenovo are members of the five-member interim board currently overseeing the partnership until official board appointments are in place. The EDPNC has also disclosed annual salaries for each of its 20 managers on staff, many of whom previously worked in economic development at the North Carolina Department of Commerce. The management salaries range from $120,000 for CEO Richard Lindemuth to $62,000 for project managers Anna Lee and Yukonda Dunn. The nonprofit partnership officially opened its office doors for business in Cary on October 6th, having been charged by state statute to take over the recruitment, marketing, and sales function of the North Carolina Department of Commerce. Also, two hotel companies propose a new property near Raleigh's Briar Creek. Not one, but two new hotel projects have been submitted for site plan review with the Raleigh Planning Department in the past month that could introduce both a new Hyatt House and a new Holiday Inn Express on properties near Briar Creek and Raleigh. The new six-story Hyatt House Hotel is proposed on a 3.5-acre site at 10,030 Salona Street next to the existing Fairfield Inn and Suites Hotel overlooking Interstate 540. Both the Fairfield and the proposed Hyatt House would be owned by Sean Chabra's CMC Hotels of Cary. It is slated to have 130 guest rooms. The new four-story 112 Holiday Inn Express Hotel will be on a four-acre site at 10450 Little Briar Creek Lane near the intersection of T.W. Alexander Drive and Glenwood Avenue. The developer of the Holiday Inn site is Harry Singh of Eastern Properties of North Carolina, Incorporated, based in South Prince Sound, Virginia. Singh acquired the land in September from Raleigh-based Cherokee Investment Partners, paying $1.25 million for the property, according to Wake County Deeds. This week's column on healthcare and biopharmaceuticals is by Jason DeBruin. His column is entitled, Biomet's New Product Focus. With a $60 million shot in the arm, Durham's Viamet Pharmaceuticals can develop antifungal treatments out of the scrutiny of public markets, giving its scientists and executives leeway to focus on the product pipeline rather than quarterly results. In July, Viamet filed to raise up to $75 million through an initial public offering, but withdrew that filing and instead announced the $60 million private placement. Additionally, the company, brought on by Bob Ingram, former GlaxoWelcome CEO, as the chairman of the board, and spun out its prostate cancer program in order to pinpoint focus on the antifungal programs instead. Robert J. Schatzinger is Viamet's CEO. Other board members include Kelly Martin and Adrian Howd. Before founding Brandon Point, Martin was the CEO of Elan, which he led to an acquisition by Perrigo for more than $8.5 billion. Howd, who has also had a long career in the biotech world, most recently led neuroscience and corporate development at Evotech before joining Brandon Point. Bringing these additions on the board in and of itself is a very meaningful part of this transaction, says Richard Katz, Viamet Chief Financial and Business Officer. The capital is one thing, but the people involved are equally important. Viamet raised the $60 million in a Series D round exclusively from Brandon Point Industries Limited and Woodford Investment Management, Hatteras Venture Partners also, and the Durham Life Sciences Venture Group, where Ingram holds office, is an investor as well, though he did not reinvest in this latest round. Other groups, including Novartis Venture Fund, Lilly Ventures, InterSouth Partners, Lurie Holdings, and Astellas Venture Management, have also invested in Viamet. There are certainly some significant disadvantages to going public, says Doug Reed, general partner with Hatteras and member of the Viamet board. Raising money privately actually is much simpler and in many cases, a less traumatic way to develop your company and your programs. Those programs for Viamet focus on antifungal agents to treat a variety of diseases. The product that is furthest along in development is called VT-1161, which Viamet has developed to treat recurrent vulvovaginal candidiasis, commonly known as vaginal yeast infection, a highly prevalent infection in women for which there are no approved therapies. In the United States, an onychomycosis, a very common fungal infection of the nail. Katz says healthcare providers have struggled in treating infections when the toenail becomes discolored or rough. Existing treatments like Lamisil, for example, work at best only about one-third of the time, largely because the pharmaceutical companies have not been able to develop a product that delivers the adequate concentration of the active drug to the nail. Also, some treatments have safety concerns, including liver toxicity. Viamet's product under development would ideally jump both of those hurdles, executives say. Viamet's product under development would ideally bring together executives that are capable of making this decision happen. Onychomycosis affected approximately 32 million individuals in the United States in 2012 and will affect as many as 38 million by 2022, according to a 2012 study by Campbell Alliance and commissioned by Viamet. The prevalence of onychomycosis increases with age, with approximately 18% of individuals over the age of 60 affected by the condition. These are billion-dollar type opportunities, Mr. Katz says. Next up, Cancer Center doctors open a Rex practice. Raleigh Clinic offers a range of oncology services. Three doctors, formerly with the Cancer Centers of North Carolina, opened a new clinic affiliated with UNC Healthcare. Cancer Centers of North Carolina dissolved October 1st, and three of its doctors formed Rex Hematology Oncology Associates at Blue Ridge, a new cancer care clinic under the Rex UNC Cancer Care banner across the street from Rex Hospital's Raleigh campus. The clinic is led by three community physicians with more than 70 years combined experience. They are Dr. Roy Cromarty, Dr. Alan Kreitz, and Dr. Mark Yaffe. Cancer Centers of North Carolina was founded in 1979 by Dr. William R. Berry and had grown to 15 physicians and a support staff of 135. Decreasing reimbursements from insurance carriers and financial pressures weighed too heavily on the practice, leading to its closing. Rex Hematology Oncology Associates of Blue Ridge is located at 2605 Blue Ridge Road and offers various cancer care services. The clinic is the newest facility within Rex UNC Cancer Care, which provides cancer treatment and support at Rex Cancer Center in Raleigh and Wakefield. The North Carolina Cancer Hospital and UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in Chapel Hill and satellite clinics in Garner, Clayton, Smithfield, and Cary. Rex UNC Cancer Care has a long history of providing top-quality cancer treatment and support services to patients in Wake County and beyond, Kreitz says. We look forward to partnering with Rex and UNC surgeons, navigators, radiologists, radiation oncologists, nutritionists, social workers, genetic counselors, and others in a collaborative manner to provide the best care for the patients we serve. Next up, not everybody gets it right. Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina sends the wrong rate information to 42,000 customers. Some 42,000 Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina customers received a letter containing incorrect rate information, the insurer reported on October 30th. The error affected only customers who are grandfathered and have a Blue Advantage health plan with a $15 copay for primary care office visits, according to Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, the state's largest health insurer. These are customers who buy on the individual market, meaning those who do not buy health insurance through an employer. We're human and sometimes we make mistakes. We regret that it happened and we're working to fix it, according to a Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina statement. This week's column by Lauren Onisorge covers technology and entrepreneurship. Her lead article this week is the CEO Forum, titled Never Let a Good Crisis Go to Waste. That's part of Duke Energy CEO Lynn Good's advice to CEOs at the North Carolina CEO Forum. Some of you may know that in February of this year, Duke had an accident, a spill into the Dan River, she says. We took immediate responsibility for that spill, but that conversation is no longer about a pipe at Dan River. It has really expanded. Even as new energy sources surface, Duke needs to explore new ways to contain coal waste, she says, and it can apply lessons from the Dan River spill to all areas of its business. We've assembled a team of outside experts to work with us so we can learn even more about how we can do better, she says. So I would say to you, I wish no spills on any of you, but there will be events that will be a catalyst, and I would say don't miss the opportunity. Also in Lauren Onisorge's column on technology and entrepreneurship, SyQwest is looking for potential acquisition targets. SyQwest took a punch in its latest earnings report, disclosing a third-quarter loss of $430,000. The company reported revenue of $25.7 million for the quarter, missing Wall Street's expectation of $25.8 million. But the Morrisville company plans to get creative in 2015 to post better numbers, says CEO Stephen Wehe. And acquisitions are a part of the strategy. We're looking for companies that we believe are fairly and reasonably priced, he says, adding that it's tough going. Everybody thinks they are worth 10 times revenue while they're burning cash and still building their product. Wehe is looking for two things in an acquisition target: something that can be sold into the company's current base and something that can attract new companies. The company has $124 million in cash and has been actively looking, even finding a couple of interesting transactions. Unfortunately, we have not been able to get ourselves comfortable with the state of the company, so we've passed on those, Wehe says. We will continue to look next year. This week's column of Technology and Entrepreneur features a They Said It column. CEOs packed into the Northridge Country Club on October 29th for a full schedule of keynotes. Here are some of the highlights in no particular order. Quote, 5% of patients are consuming 55% of resources, end quote. That comes from Karen Ignagani, President and CEO of America's Health Insurance Plans. Our governor, Mr. Pat McCrory, is quoted as saying, there can be a huge energy renaissance in North Carolina, end quote. In this, he was pointing out the planned pipeline and Duke Energy's big presence and in North Carolina. And finally, Tom Pike, CEO of Quintiles, is quoted as saying, you have to be able to ask the questions that will help you understand what the issues are. Relentless execution It has to be based in reality. End quote. Next up, more from the CEO Forum. PNC Financial Exec, the day my identity was stolen. William Demchak, Chairman, President, and CEO of the PNC Financial Services Group, was sitting down for his morning coffee in October when he became a statistic. Demchak was checking his email when there at the top of the list was a message from William Demchak. That was a surprise to the William Demchak, he told a crowd of CEOs at the North Carolina CEO Forum. It's offering me this phenomenal $30 million investment opportunity. Time was of the essence, he said. He had a good chuckle until the other emails started rolling in from others who had also gotten the email. So I logged in to LinkedIn, and there I was, twice. The second Bill Demchak looked just like the real William Demchak, complete with PNC's Washington address and his corporate portrait as a profile photo. The guy was blogging, he says. He had 500 connections in a day, and I was starting to get a little worried. So he decided to call the number in the profile. A Mr. William answered. Eventually, Demchak revealed who he was. I'm Bill Demchak. I run PNC. He said, terrific. I'm so glad we'll be working together. For Demchak, it was an easy fix. After all, he has bank employees devoted to cybersecurity issues. But it was an enlightening situation, made more serious by the numbers. Numbers like 1.3 billion security instances popping up per day in the month of September. It's part of a global problem. 47% of PNC clients are primarily digital, he says, and 43% of its deposits are being made by phone or intelligent ATMs. Compare that to the way it used to be, where banking was local and everything the bank knew about you was maintained at the local branch. The world is changing around me, Demchak says. We know we need to deal with it. We've seen what happens to companies who don't deal with it. Think about what happened with Blockbuster Video and Netflix. It's my job to invest in the future. But the bank has a more basic job. Banking, at its most fundamental core, should be about safety for our clients, he says, adding that banks are the ones that eat the cost when there is a fraudulent charge because of a Target or a Home Depot. And that's why banks and companies have to invest in their futures. For PNC, security is a big part of that investment. Let's invest in our future. As you get ready for capital budgeting this year, take a look at your high school yearbook. Take a look at it. There's a lot that's changed. More complex cards with chip technology are coming, he says, adding that fraudsters won't be able to copy your magnetic strip because codes will be constantly changing. And point-of-sale systems will also be taking phone payments. Tokenization, where one number will only work one time in e-commerce transactions, will also be changing. But they'll come up with the next new thing, and we'll have to react to that as well, he says. This week's column from Dawn Wallace covers small business personalities and triangle trends. She's got a column here that says, Loaned Executive Banks on Short-Term Leadership. It's a question and answer from the Triangle Business Journal with Mr. T. Rex Ferguson as a CEO for hire. While consultants create a plan for a business, he does the actual work, whether it's managing payroll, negotiating mergers and acquisitions, or monitoring a business over time. For the last 7 years, Ferguson has worked for an average of 5 businesses at a time, from California to North Carolina. He lives in Hickory, but goes wherever a company needs him to be. His background is in engineering and technical sales. He worked for Allen Bradley, the company now owned by Rockwell Automation, from which he retired as vice president and general manager. He and his business partner, Tom Freener, aim to add partners to their firm, Tom Shared Executive, and grow in the triangle. TBJ, how did you go from engineering and sales to running companies? Mr. Ferguson, my boss was always teaching me to run a company. If he saw I could do something, he'd give me more assignments that had nothing to do with my job. Looking back, I could see he was showing me how to run the company. TBJ, what's your business model? Mr. Ferguson, I'm with a company for a minimum of 4 months. It depends on what the company needs. I work on plans for growth, cost-cutting, negotiating new contracts, and how to make the client more successful. TBJ, how many clients have you had in the last 7 years of doing this? Mr. Ferguson, I have had 30 customers. The smallest ones are 6 months and the longest keep going. I'm still working with one I started with 6 years ago. My assignments change there quite a bit. Now it's a quarterly thing. I look at the monthly financials and do quarterly strategic planning. TBJ, how would you describe your clients? Mr. Ferguson, they are typically in the $1 million to $20 million range in revenue. Next up, a more efficient helicopter. Carrie's Lord Corporation working towards a better chopper for the U.S. Army. Thanks to Carrie's adhesive and vibration management company, Lord Corps, the U.S. Army could get a more efficient helicopter to replace the Kiowa Warrior helicopter fleet. Aircraft manufacturer Sikorsky, a subsidiary of United Technologies Corporation, launched a program 4 years ago to develop a helicopter with improved performance, and Lord partnered with 53 other companies on the project. The outcome is the S-97 Raider, a helicopter with improved maneuverability, hover efficiency, hot climate performance, and speed. This helicopter is capable of carrying external weapons and 6 troops. This new generation of helicopters will allow the pilot to have more control over the aircraft by way of design from Lord that adjusts the pitch of the rotor blades. Our active vibration control system keeps vibration levels down to a minimum, says Karen Doriel, staff program manager at Lord. The new craft also features coaxial counter-rotating main rotors and a pusher propeller that will offer more efficient movement. The use of Lord's ultra-conductive solutions protects from direct lightning strikes, allows fasteners to be more grounded, and allows the aircraft to be manufactured more easily, according to Sikorsky. The S-97 Raider will be offered as a replacement for the OH-58D Kiowa Warrior. That helicopter, made by Bell Helicopter in the 1960s, was originally the OH-58D, and the Army used the helicopter in the late 80s primarily for field artillery observation. Later, the OH-58D was outfitted with thermal vision capabilities, wire cutters to protect the blades, and weapons mounted on both sides of the aircraft, and was dubbed the Kiowa Warrior. Next up, the Executive Voice. Interview with Janet Cowell, From Wall Street to Main Street. Janet Cowell's pivot from private to public sector. This interview was produced by Lauren Onisorge. Before being sworn in as North Carolina's first female state treasurer, Janet Cowell was a state senator, a Raleigh City Council member, and a Lehman Brothers analyst. The University of Pennsylvania graduate didn't set out to be a politician. She set out to be an analyst, working with the likes of Lehman and HSBC. But the Memphis, Tennessee-born Cowell's life took a big pivot in 2001 when an interest in neighborhood planning led her to run and win a city council seat alongside Cree innovator Neil Hunt. In the 13 years that followed, she hasn't looked back, defeating Republican Bill Daughtridge in 2008 to become state treasurer. On weekdays, Cowell manages the 10th largest public pension fund in the country, but come Saturday, you'll likely find her on a bicycle or jogging on the Greenway. One thing you won't find her doing, backing down from a critic. TBJ, what did you want to be when you grew up? Ms. Cowell, a teacher, like my mother. TBJ, what was your favorite subject in school, and why? Ms. Cowell, learning a foreign language. German allowed me to travel and be an exchange student. TBJ, if you weren't the state treasurer, what's your dream backup job? Ms. Cowell, diplomat. TBJ, what made you go into politics? Ms. Cowell, I got involved at the neighborhood level, discussing planning and urban growth, and ran for Raleigh City Council. TBJ, what apps are on your phone? Ms. Cowell, Bloomberg, Stocks, R. Greenway, Raleigh Greenway System Guide, Who's, Home Improvement and Decorating, and Strava, Running and Cycling. TBJ, What's the last book you read? Miss Cowell, I am Malala, the girl who stood up for education and was shot by the Taliban. By Malala Yousafzai. TBJ, what's your idea of a perfect day? Perfect Saturday. Ms. Cowell, I would start the day at a coffee shop, followed by a bike ride, and then I would make progress on a home improvement project and end the day cooking out with family and friends. TBJ, of all the political issues being discussed in North Carolina, what issue is, in your opinion, overrated, and what issue is underrated? Ms. Cowell, overrated, the focus on the horse race of federal elections. In practice, local and state government policies have much more direct impact on people's lives. Underrated, poverty and the plight of the working poor. North Carolina was hit hard by the recession and the state has bounced back, but many of our citizens are still struggling. TBJ, what's been your biggest professional challenge and how did you overcome it? Ms. Cowell, balancing being an elected official with the duties of an office that requires nonpartisan professional management. My approach has always been, and remains, to do what is right, regardless of politics, for the people of North Carolina. I have worked and continue to work to modernize the Department of State Treasurer and to make it a model state agency using private sector best practices. TBJ, there's been some criticism about the amount of money you raised from out-of-state donors during your campaign. What do you tell those critics concerned about your ties to Wall Street? Ms. Cowell, political issues have no role in investment decision-making. None. I have worked to set up buffers to protect our professional investment operations from politics and political influence. In addition, I have been a consistent and vocal advocate of public financing for the treasurer's race. TBJ, what question do you get asked the most? Ms. Cowell, quote, how's my money doing? End quote. Or, quote, are you taking good care of my money? End quote. I'm glad to be asked because I can share that we have one of the strongest pensions in the nation. TBJ, what would surprise North Carolinians about their treasurer? Ms. Cowell, that I'm a PK. A preacher's kid. TBJ, of what professional accomplishment are you most proud? Ms. Cowell, stepping up and assuming leadership of the state health plan. After years of financial instability, the state health plan is on solid footing, and we've reduced the unfunded liability by over $10 billion without reducing benefits for members. TBJ, do you have any mentors? If so, who are they and how have they shaped you? Ms. Cowell, the late John Medlin, the former CEO of Wachovia. He was one of the most respected bankers in the country and certainly one of the most guarded of his generation, most regarded of his generation. He epitomized the best qualities of North Carolina by being conservative, but also being forward-thinking. TBJ, what are your hobbies outside of pension planning? Ms. Cowell, I enjoy outdoor running and biking. We have many beautiful parks and trails in North Carolina, and I also enjoy home improvement projects. What comes next is the Small Business Column by Jim Verdonik. Mr. Verdonik is an attorney with Ward & Smith. His column is entitled, The Golden Rule Won't Save You from Government. Many people ask, what's the most common mistake entrepreneurs make? We see many mistakes repeated, he says. Too little capital. Unrealistic time schedules. No market intelligence. The most common mistake entrepreneurs make is that they think it's okay to treat their employees as they treat themselves. What's wrong with living by the golden rule when we were taught by parents and preachers? Remember that most people who start businesses, A, work for free for many months, sometimes years, B, suspend their own pay when sales fall, C, don't track the number of hours they work, D, don't contribute to payroll taxes like Social Security and Medicare for their unpaid hours, and E, trade favors with others to obtain services in a non-cash economy. Many Silicon Valley employees might have become rich through sweat equity, but government values abiding by its rules more than you making your employees rich. So remember this. The government considers sweat equity the same as paying employees with lottery tickets. You need to pay cash to comply with minimum wage and overtime laws, and calling people founders doesn't mean they are not employees. Entrepreneurs are creative people. Having determined that hiring employees is just a big pain in the rear, entrepreneurs invented virtual businesses that function with no employees or very few employees. Governments despise virtual companies because they make many employment laws irrelevant. Government officials don't like being irrelevant. That's why government plays a continuing game of cat and mouse with entrepreneurs and the virtual companies they create. Government continually challenges whether virtual companies really have no employees. Entrepreneurs often call everyone independent contractors. So government imposes rules that determine whether independent contractors are really employees. These rules are too complex to describe here, but the primary thing to remember is that the title you give people is less important than the nature of your overall relationship. Recently, local headlines told us that construction companies are avoiding unemployment insurance and other taxes by treating too many people as independent contractors. The construction industry may be the government's and media's current primary target, but if government and media scrutinized most young software and biomedical businesses, they would find the same problems. Independent contractor misclassification usually involves individuals who work directly with your company. Outsourcing is another way entrepreneurs tell the government where it can put its employment laws. When businesses outsource functions, they hire someone else to do the paperwork. They also reduce their employee headcount below the number required to provide health insurance or comply with other government mandates. Government examines whether outsourcing companies really are independent. Cross-ownership or other affiliations may cause government to challenge these relationships. Government is even asserting that for certain purposes, the employees of franchisees are also employees of the franchisors. The bottom line, when you start a business, government is your partner, and we all know that government is never a silent partner. Next up, Viewpoint. The Triangle Business Journal welcomes letters to the editor. This week's editor's notebook is from Sugata Mukherjee and is entitled, Time for Airlines to Give Something Back to Flyers. Enough. Where is the outrage? No, not with the results of the U.S. midterm elections, but with the preposterous increases in airline fees and surcharges in the past 2 years. A new report released November 4th concluded airlines will charge about $29 billion in a la carte fees to passengers in 2014, up 20% from 2013. 20%, yes, you heard that right. Those fees include charges for checked or carry-on bags, seating assignments, food, beverages, and yes, internet service. Mind you, these increases come on top of the base fare increases in 2014, which have gone up more than 11% since 2009, according to the airline research firm IdeaWorks Company. Airlines were able to increase base prices as they eliminated available seats from flights to throw off the supply and demand balance. After you digest all that, here's the kicker. Oil prices are falling and operating margins have improved substantially for all air carriers. Ask these airline executives and they will tell you when oil prices were soaring, airlines were losing billions of dollars. Many filed for bankruptcy, and others mothballed their fixed-cost assets, also known as airplanes, to survive the oil price surge and the Great Recession. But things have changed. Why are plane tickets so high? Not only that, just 3 weeks ago, large carriers announced a price increase of $4 per ticket. And you know how these price increases stick? It's when one announces the increase, others follow. That's how. Granted, the economics of supply and demand determine the price points of fares, but it is far from truth when it comes to charging $20 for an aisle or exit row seat or $10 for Wi-Fi service. So airlines in this upcoming holiday season, how about throwing a bone to the folks who fly with you? Maybe for a month you offer passengers free food and drinks. What do you say, American, Delta, U.S. Airways, and others? Just as you raise your base prices, maybe one of you can start offering this holiday treat and see if the others follow suit. If they don't, go ahead and still do it. Be a leader. You may increase that loyal customer base. In the end, what's preventing these carriers from ratcheting down the fees machine is Wall Street. Analysts expect that revenue stream. Only two groups of people can reverse this runaway trend: consumers and Congress. We don't want Congress to do anything. Wait, they're already good at that. So it's up to the consumers to let their voices be heard. Otherwise, we're staring at another 20-odd% increase in ancillary fees next year. Next is this week's guest column. Paul Mead is the president of Thought Leader Select, a healthcare consulting firm in Chapel Hill. Mr. Mead's column is entitled Reviewing Doctor Payments in Context. Over the last month, the media and public have pored over freshly released data revealing payments made by pharmaceutical companies and medical device manufacturers to physicians and teaching hospitals. The release of this information was mandated under the Physician Payment Sunshine Act, part of the Affordable Care Act, with the admirable goal of increasing healthcare transparency. Unfortunately, the lack of context surrounding these payments and resultant misinterpretation has left many on both sides of the equation worried about potential fallout due to the negative public perception of relationships between manufacturers and healthcare professionals. Indeed, the raw data released in phases within searchable public databases seems to beg for a witch hunt. The prosecution of doctors with high earnings in the court of public opinion based on a misguided rush to judgment. Is this the proper reaction? No. But if allowed, it could have dire repercussions should physicians come under pressure to stop accepting this money and thus stop working with the industry. Additionally, under the law, payments made to clinical research hospitals like Duke University and Medical Center and UNC Health must be reported. Giving declining government funding under the National Institutes of Health and other grant programs money from the private sector is more critical than ever. What's more, there are multiple doctors, some of the world's leading specialists, who are receiving compensation for devices they helped develop for their patients. Imagine the brain drain that might occur if such talented physicians left the Triangle, or even the United States, for a more hospitable environment where they could pursue their careers without unfair judgment. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.